A poor maid was about to lose everything she had in the world, and she would lose it for the only thing she had ever done right. She did not know it yet. She was on her knees on a cold marble floor, mending a rich woman's gown with hands that had never once been thanked, when the door of the grandest dress salon in London opened, and the Winter walked in wearing the face of a freezing old woman in rags. Every fine lady in that glittering room would laugh at the beggar. Every one of them would turn away. Only the maid would kneel and offer warmth, and for that single act of mercy she would be thrown out into the snow with empty hands and no notion at all of what she had done. For the trembling old woman in the torn cloak was not a beggar. She was the mother of a duke, and she had come in disguise to learn the true hearts of the people who smiled at her son. By nightfall she would know them all, and the poor maid, who had nothing, who had asked for nothing, was about to shake the foundations of an entire dukedom without ever meaning to. This is the story of how a cup of tea, offered to a stranger no one else would touch, brought a proud house to its knees, unmasked a beautiful liar, and lifted a forgotten girl higher than she ever dared to dream. It begins, as so many true things do, in the cold. The snow fell soft over London that afternoon, the kind of snow that hushed the carriages and turned the gas lamps into pale golden ghosts. But inside Madame Adrienne Belmont's grand dress salon on Harrow Street, the world was warm and bright and merciless. Light poured from the great chandelier overhead and scattered across 100 glass surfaces. Gowns of plum silk and sea-green satin hung along the walls like sleeping queens. Pearls rested under glass in long velvet trays, and bolts of gold-threaded fabric leaned in the corners as though waiting to be crowned. Mirrors framed in gilt rose from floor to ceiling, and in them the wealthy women of the city admired themselves from every angle, laughing behind painted fans, their voices light as breaking china. Among all that shimmer, on her knees beside a cutting table, knelt Lydia Thornton. She wore a plain black dress and a white apron, both clean, both worn thin at the edges. Her brown hair was pinned into a simple, careful bun, and her hands, small and quick, moved a needle through the torn hem of a countess's ball gown. She had been mending it for the better part of an hour. No one had asked her name. No one would thank her. When the countess returned, Madame Belmont would smooth the silk, smile, and accept the praise as her own. Lydia did not mind, or told herself she did not. She had learned long ago that a poor girl who wished to keep her place must learn to disappear. She tied off the thread, bit it clean, and ran her thumb over the seam to be certain it would hold. It would. Her work always held. "Girl," came a voice above her. "The tea has gone cold at the far table. Are we to wait all winter?" That was Mrs. Blythe Cresswell, the senior attendant, a tall woman with a thin mouth and a thinner patience. Lydia rose, gathered the cold pot, and went to fetch a fresh one without a word. It was then that the bell above the door rang, and the cold came in. A woman stepped through the doorway, small and bent, wrapped in a cloak so worn that the wind had found a dozen ways through it. The hem was torn and dark with melted snow. Her bonnet sagged, stained by rain, and her gloves were split at the fingers. She moved slowly, one hand pressed to her chest as though to keep her own warmth from escaping, and she paused just inside the door as the heat of the room touched her face. The laughter did not stop all at once. It died in pieces, the way candles do when a window is opened. One by one the fine ladies turned, and their fans lowered, and their eyes went hard and bright, with the particular cruelty of people who have never once been cold. "Good heavens," murmured a young heiress near the mirrors. "Has the parish begun delivering its poor to our door?" A ripple of amusement went round the room. Lydia, returning with the fresh pot, stopped where she stood. Madame Belmont swept forward in a rustle of charcoal taffeta. She was elegant in the way a blade is elegant, all clean lines and cold polish, dressed finer than a shopkeeper, and not quite so fine as the women she served, which was a wound she carried everywhere. She looked the old woman over from sagging bonnet to broken boot, and her lip curled. "You have mistaken the establishment, I think," Madame Belmont said, her voice smooth as the silk she sold. "This is a salon, not a parish kitchen. Charity is dispensed two streets over. Kindly take yourself there before you frighten my customers." The old woman lifted her head. Her face was deeply lined, her cheeks hollow, her lips pale with cold. But her eyes, when they rose, were dark and steady and strangely unafraid. "I wished only," she said, in a thin and trembling voice, "to look upon a ribbon. I have not seen anything so fine in a long while." "I am quite sure you haven't," said Lady Seraphina Morcant. She had risen from the velvet chaise by the largest mirror, and every eye turned to her, for Lady Seraphina was the sort of beauty that made rooms forget themselves. Her gown was the deep green of a forest at dusk, her gloves dyed to match, and a rope of pearls lay against the white of her throat. She crossed the floor with the unhurried grace of a woman who had never once been told to wait, and she stopped before the old woman and tilted her lovely head. "Look all you like," Seraphina said sweetly. "Only do not touch. The dirt of the street has a way of clinging to silk, and silk has a way of remembering." She smiled. "Some stains never come out." The ladies laughed again, delighted. Mrs. Cresswell stepped forward, her hands already lifting, as though to take the old woman by the shoulders and steer her out into the snow, and Lydia set down the teapot. She did not decide to do it. There was no grand thought, no swelling of courage in her breast. She simply could not stand still and watch a cold woman pushed back into the cold. She crossed the room, slipped past Mrs. Cresswell's reaching hands, and took the old woman gently by the arm. "Come and sit," Lydia said softly. "There is a chair by the stove. You are half frozen, Thornton." Madame Belmont's voice cracked like a whip. "What in heaven's name do you imagine you are doing?" "She is cold, madame," Lydia said, not turning. "That is all. She is only cold." She guided the old woman to the small chair near the iron stove at the back of the salon, the one where the seamstresses warmed their hands on bitter mornings. The old woman sank into it with a sigh that seemed to come from the very bottom of her. Lydia knelt, took the split, frozen gloves from those trembling hands, and wrapped them instead in a clean square of flannel she kept in her apron for pressing seams. Then she poured a cup of the fresh tea, still steaming, and folded the old woman's fingers around it. "There," Lydia murmured. "Hold it close. The warmth will come back. It always does." The old woman looked at her for a long moment. The whole salon had gone silent, but Lydia did not notice. She was watching the color return slowly to the old woman's lips. "Why," the old woman said quietly, so quietly that only Lydia could hear, "would a girl like you risk so much for a stranger in rags?" "They will not love you for it." Lydia smiled, a small and tired smile. "Cold is cold, ma'am," she said. "It does not care whether it touches a duchess or a beggar, and neither, I think, should I." Something moved across the old woman's face then. It was not pity, and it was not surprise. It was something closer to recognition, as though she had been searching a long time for a particular thing, and had at last found it. But Madame Belmont had reached them. "Get up," she hissed. "Get up this instant." Lydia rose. "You have shamed this house in front of every lady of consequence in London," Madame Belmont said, her face white with fury. "You have put your servant's hands on my customer's silk, and coddled a beggar in my salon, as though it were an almshouse. I have warned you before about your airs, Thornton, your dreams of needles and patterns above your station. I will not warn you again." She drew herself up. "You are dismissed. Collect nothing. Your wages are forfeit, for the embarrassment you have caused. Get out." The word fell like a stone into still water. Lydia stood very still. She had known cruelty in that room 100 times, but she had never been thrown out into the snow, with empty hands and winter coming. For a moment, the gilt mirrors, and the laughing ladies, and the pearls under glass all blurred together, and she felt the floor tilt beneath her. Then she steadied. She untied her apron, folded it neatly, and set it on the cutting table where she had knelt so many hours of her life. She looked once at the old woman by the stove, who was watching her now with dark and burning eyes, and she said very simply, "Stay warm, ma'am, please," and she walked out into the snow. Behind her the laughter rose again, brittle and bright, but the old woman did not laugh. She sat very still by the stove, the warm cup in her hands, and she watched the door close on the only person in that glittering room who had treated her as though she were a human being. Slowly, beneath her ragged hood, the Dowager Duchess Isolde Harrowby began to smile. "Greetings, dear viewers. Your support is needed to take this channel farther, and we are so very grateful. If you enjoy these tales of old Victorian England, of dukes and secrets and quiet courage, do well to subscribe, leave a like, and tell us where in the world you are listening from, the country, the time, and the day. Support us in any way you can, for your kindness helps this little candle of a channel burn brighter and travel farther than we ever could alone. Thank you so much. Now then, let us go back to the snow on Harrow Street, where a dismissed maid does not yet know that her small act of mercy has begun to shake the foundations of a dukedom. To understand what Lydia Thornton lost that afternoon, one must understand what little she had. She had come to London at 17, an orphan from a Kentish village, where her mother had been the finest needlewoman in 3 parishes before the fever took her. Her mother had left Lydia 2 things, a small tin box of needles and a gift in her fingers that could not be taught. By 22, Lydia could look at a torn seam and know in an instant how to mend it so that no eye would ever find the wound. She could match thread to silk in candlelight. She could take a gown a season out of fashion and, with a few hours' quiet work, make it new again. And for all of this, Madame Belmont paid her the wages of a charwoman and called her a maid. The salon had taken her on 3 winters past, when she was hungry enough to take anything. She had been told she would learn the trade. Instead, she learned to polish the glass cases until her reflection stared back at her from among the pearls. She learned to carry tea and empty wash basins and sweep the threads from the fitting room floors. And in the evenings, when the proper seamstresses had gone home, and a gown lay ruined by some clumsy hand, it was Lydia who was woken and set to mend it, and Lydia whose work was praised the next morning in another woman's name. She had borne it because she had no choice, and because she had a dream she told no one. She kept it folded small inside her, the way she kept her mother's needles. One day she would have a shop of her own. A small, clean place with good light, where a poor woman could bring a worn dress and leave with it made beautiful, and where the who did the work would be thanked for it. It was a foolish dream for a maid with no money and no family. She knew that. She held it anyway. On the morning before the old woman came, a junior seamstress named Alice had wept in the back room because she had cut a duchess. S-bodice an inch too short, and the Duchess was to wear it to the Stonehurst Winter Ball. The Stonehurst Ball was the great event of the season. Half of London's gowns were being made for it, and Madame Belmont's reputation rode upon every stitch. "It cannot be fixed," Alice had sobbed. "She comes at noon. Madame will turn me out." Lydia had taken the bodice, turned it in the light, and seen at once what could be done. She set in a panel of matching silk, hidden in the seam, and let the bodice out a careful inch, so that no living eye would ever know. It took her 2 hours. She gave Alice the gown at 11:30 and said nothing. At noon, the Duchess came and tried the gown and pronounced it perfection. And Madame Belmont, smoothing the silk with her ringed hands, had said, "I cut it myself to your figure, Your Grace. I trust no other hands with work so fine." Lydia had been on her knees 3 feet away, polishing the brass foot of a mirror, and she had said nothing at all. It was perhaps an hour later that Lady Seraphina Morkant arrived to be fitted for her own ball gown, and that was the first time Lydia ever heard her speak. Seraphina swept in with her brother, Lord Alaric Morkant, a tall, pale young man with restless eyes and a smile that never quite reached them. While Madame Belmont fussed over measurements, Seraphina spoke of the ball as though it were already hers. "The Duke will dance the first with me, of course," she said, turning before the mirror so the green silk caught the light. "Mother has all but arranged it. By spring I shall be mistress of Stonehurst, and then we shall see some changes in this city." "You are very certain of him," her brother murmured. "He is a man, Alaric, and men are certain of whatever is put before them often enough." She laughed. "Besides, who else is there? Half the eligible girls in London are dull as dishwater, and the other half are poor. A duke does not marry poor." Then her eye fell on Lydia, kneeling by the mirror with her cloth. "And do see that creature does not breathe on my gown," Seraphina said. "I cannot abide the smell of servants. They carry the street in their very skin." Madame Belmond laughed as though it were the wittiest thing she had ever heard. Lydia kept her eyes down and her hands moving, and she felt the old familiar heat of shame crawl up her neck. She had learned to swallow it. She swallowed it now. But she did not know, kneeling there with her cloth, that the woman who had just called her a creature would one day kneel far lower than the floor of any salon, and she did not know that the great doors were about to open, and that the cold would come in, and that her small life was about to change forever. The bell above the door rang. We return now to that afternoon, and to what came after Lydia walked out into the snow, for the story of the salon was not yet finished. When the door had closed behind the dismissed maid, the Dowager Duchess Isolde Harrowby sat a while longer by the stove, and let the tea warm her from the inside. She was 63 years old, and she had been a great lady all her life, and she had grown weary of the way greatness lied to her. For her son Evander, the Duke of Stonehurst, was of an age to marry, and every ambitious house in England had thrown its daughters at his feet. They came to Stonehurst House in their silks and their pearls, and they smiled at the Dowager Duchess, and called her dear, and pressed her hand, and told her she did not look a day past 50. And Isolde, who was no fool, watched their eyes when they thought she was not looking, and saw in them only the glitter of the title her son carried. She had wished, just once, to know how such women behaved toward those they believed beneath them. So she had borrowed an old gardener's cloak and a charwoman's boots, and she had gone out into the city as a beggar to see what she would find. She had been turned from 3 doorways before she came to Harrow Street, and there in the cruelest and finest room of all, she had found Lydia. She finished her tea, she rose, leaving the warm flannel folded on the chair, and she walked toward the door. Seraphina's voice followed her, light and amused. "Do mind the snow does not melt on the Aubusson, dear. We have only just had it cleaned." Isolde stopped. She turned, and for one moment something flickered in her bent old frame that made Madame Belmont smile falter without her knowing why, but the moment passed. The Dowager Duchess only inclined her head, murmured a thanks that no one believed was sincere, and went out into the falling snow. A carriage waited for her at the corner of Harrow Street, plain and black, and without a crest. The footman who handed her in did not laugh at her rags, for he knew exactly who she was, As the wheels turned toward Mayfair, Isolde sat back against the cushions and pressed the warm flannel to her cheek, and she thought of the girl with the steady hands who had said, "Cold is cold." Inside the salon, Miss Viola Pemberley had watched it all. Viola was the youngest of the salon's workers, a slight, freckled girl of 19, who had been there but a year and who jumped whenever Mrs. Cresswell raised her voice. She had liked Lydia. Lydia had taught her how to thread a needle in poor light without straining her eyes, and had shared her own dinner more than once when Viola had spent her wages on medicine for her mother. Viola had watched Lydia kneel by the old woman, and watched her dismissed, and watched her walk out with nothing. And she had said not one word in her defense. She told herself there had been nothing she could say. She told herself a word from her would only have cost her own place. And her mother needed the medicine, and what good would two ruined girls be instead of one? She told herself all of this, and she believed none of it, and the shame of her silence settled into her chest and stayed there like a swallowed stone. Across the room, Madame Belmont was already smiling again, pouring fresh praise upon Lady Seraphina. The ugliness of the last quarter hour swept under the carpet with the melted snow. She had no notion that she had just dismissed the only person who could have saved her. She had no notion of anything at all, save the pleasant weight of Morkent Gold, and the certainty that the world would go on, bowing to those who could pay. "A wretched business, Mrs.," Cresswell said, smoothing her skirts. "Beggars at the door. One does not know what the city is coming to." "It is coming to ruin," Seraphina agreed, admiring her own reflection. "Which is precisely why people of quality must hold the line. Sentiment is a luxury, madame. The poor cannot afford it, and we should not indulge it." She turned now. "About the train of the gown, I want it longer than any other ladies in the room. I intend to be remembered." "You shall be my lady," said Madame Belmont. "You shall be," and so she would, but not at all in the way she meant. Lydia walked a long way in the snow that afternoon, because she did not know what else to do. She had 2 shillings in her pocket, and a single tin box of needles, and these were the whole of her fortune in the world. She walked until the cold had numbed her feet, and her tears had frozen on her cheeks, and then she found her way back to the narrow boarding house off Cheapside, where she rented a single cold room beneath the eaves. Mrs. Harker, the landlady, met her on the stairs. "Rent's due Friday," she said, not unkindly, but not kindly either. "I'll need it Friday, or the room goes to the cobbler's daughter." "You shall have it," Lydia said, though she did not know how. In her room she lit no fire, for coal cost money. She sat on the edge of her narrow bed in her cloak, and looked at the small grey square of window, and tried to think. She could mend gloves. There was a haberdasher near the river who sometimes paid a penny apiece for gloves repaired well, and Lydia could repair them better than anyone. A penny a glove. She would need a great many gloves. She took out her mother's needles and set to work on a torn pair she had been keeping. And she did not let herself weep, because weeping would not pay Mrs. Harker on Friday. Meanwhile, across the city, at Stonehurst House, a storm of another kind was breaking. Evander Harrowby, 4th Duke of Stonehurst, was a man of 32, tall and dark, and built like the men in the old family portraits who had ridden to war. He had a grave, handsome face and a habit of stillness that strangers mistook for coldness. He had inherited the dukedom at 25 when his father died, and in 7 years he had learned that a great title is a great weight, and that the higher a man stands, the more carefully he must watch where he sets his feet. He had grown guarded. He kept his own counsel. He trusted few, and he had been taught by 100 grasping smiles to suspect that everyone who came to him wanted something. When his mother's plain carriage rolled into the courtyard, he was in his study, and he came out to the hall in some surprise, for he had not known she was abroad. She came in still wrapped in the ragged cloak. "Mother," he said, and stopped. "What in God's name are you wearing?" "A lesson, Evander," Isolde said. She let the footman take the wretched cloak, and stood revealed beneath it in her own fine grey gown, small and straight and entirely herself again, save for the cold still in her hands. "I have spent the afternoon as a beggar in the finest salon in London. Do you know what I learned?" "I cannot imagine," he said, frowning. "Are you hurt? You are frozen through. Rawthorn, send for tea and brandy," and the fire built up. "I learned," she went on, ignoring all of it, "that the women who smile at your title would not cross a room to keep an old woman from freezing. I was mocked, Evander. I was called a beggar to my face, and very nearly thrown into the snow by a hired woman's hands." The fine ladies laughed. "Lady Seraphina Morkant, whom your aunt is so very eager you should marry, told me that some stains never come out. She meant me." The Duke's jaw had gone hard. "She did not know you." "Of course she did not know me. That is the entire point." His mother's dark eyes were bright. "A person's true face is the one they wear toward those who can do nothing for them, and I saw a great many true faces this afternoon, all of them ugly." She paused, and her voice changed. "All but one." "One?" "A maid," said Isolde. "A girl in a black dress and a white apron, who knelt on that fine floor, and took the cold gloves off my hands, and wrapped them warm, and gave me tea, and called me ma'am as though I were a queen. And when I asked her why she would risk her place for a stranger in rags, she told me that cold is cold, whether it touches a duchess or a beggar." The old woman's voice trembled now, but not from the cold. "And for that, Evander, for that single kindness, that woman Belmont dismissed her on the spot, forfeited her wages, cast her out into the snow with nothing, while the fine ladies laughed." The study had gone very quiet. Mr. Edmund Rawthorn, the Duke's solicitor and man of business, stood in the doorway with his ledgers, and he had heard every word, and his neat, watchful face had gone still. "What was her name?" the Duke asked. "I did not learn it," Isolde said. "There was no time, but I will know her face among 10,000. Find her, Evander. I do not care what it costs. Find that girl, and see that she does not freeze for the crime of being decent to me." The Duke turned to his solicitor. "Rawthorn, sir, you heard." "I did, sir. Madame Belmont's salon, Harrow Street." "A maid dismissed this afternoon. Find her. Find where she lodges. Do it quietly, and do it quickly." His dark eyes were unreadable. "And make discreet inquiries into the salon itself, while you are about it. I have a sudden curiosity about how Madame Belmont conducts her affairs." "At once, sir," said Rawthorn, and bowed and went. It took him 2 days. Edmund Rawthorn was a thorough man, the sort who pulled a single thread and followed it to the whole garment. He learned the maid's name was Lydia Thornton. He learned she had worked 3 years for wages a stable boy would scorn. He learned from a tearful-lunged salon worker, met by chance in the street, that the maid was the finest pair of hands in the establishment, and that her work was passed off as Madame Belmont's own. And he learned, last of all, where she lodged. On the third day, a black carriage drew up outside Mrs. Harker's boarding house off Cheapside, and the whole street came to its windows to stare. Lydia was mending gloves by the grey light of her window when the knock came. Mrs. Harker's voice, breathless and astonished, called up the stairs. "Miss Thornton. Miss Thornton, there's a gentleman. A proper gentleman in a carriage, and he's asking for you by name." Lydia came down with her needles still in her hand. In the narrow hall stood a neat, grave man, in a dark coat, hat held to his chest, who looked at her with a kind of careful respect she had not been shown in years. "Miss Lydia Thornton," he said. "I am she. My name is Edmund Rawthorn. I have the honor of serving the Duke of Stonehurst." He paused. "3 afternoons ago, You showed a kindness to an old woman in a dress salon and were dismissed for it. Lydia's heart turned over. I want no trouble, sir, she said quickly. Whatever the woman was, I meant only to keep her warm. If I have done wrong, you have done no wrong, Rawthorne said gently. You have done a great right, and you do not yet know how great. The old woman you helped was the Dowager Duchess Isolde Harrowby, the mother of the Duke himself. The hall went very still. Mrs. Harker made a small sound like a kettle. That is not possible, Lydia whispered. It is the simple truth. She went among society in disguise to learn the character of those around her son. You alone treated her with decency. She has not stopped speaking of you since. Rawthorne's voice softened further. She wishes to thank you, Miss Thornton. She asks that you come to Stonehurst House. The Duke's carriage is at your service. Lydia looked down at the half-mended glove in her hand and her 2 shillings worth of life, and she felt the whole world tilt for the second time in 3 days. I want no charity, sir, she said at last, lifting her chin. I will not be paid for common decency. But her voice wavered. Belmont kept the wages I had honestly earned. If your Duke can see those returned to me, I will come and thank the lady myself, for she was very kind to me too in her way. That is all I want, the wages I earned, and nothing I did not. Edmund Rawthorne looked at her for a long moment, and something in his grave face very nearly became a smile. Miss Thornton, he said, I begin to understand why Her Grace cannot stop speaking of you. Come, the carriage is waiting. And Lydia Thornton put on her thin cloak and tucked her mother's needles into her pocket and walked out of the boarding house and into a black carriage, bearing a crest she could not read, with no notion at all that she would never again live a small life. Stonehurst House rose at the end of a long gravel drive like something out of a ken. Story Lydia had been told as a child and never believed. It was vast and pale and grand, with tall windows that caught the winter light, and great stone lions guarding the steps. As the carriage drew up, footmen in dark livery came down to open the door, and Lydia, in her thin cloak with her 2 shillings and her tin of needles, stepped out onto gravel that had been raked smooth as a tablecloth, and felt very small indeed. Inside, the hall was larger than the whole boarding house where she lodged. The floor was marble, black and white in great squares, and a staircase swept up and up beneath portraits of stern Harrowbys, who looked down at her as though they knew precisely what she was and what she was not. Lydia clasped her hands before her and tried not to gape, and failed. Miss Thornton. The Dowager Duchess came toward her across the marble, and Lydia knew her at once, though the rags were gone, and in their place was fine grey silk and a small fortune in lace. The bent old beggar of the salon had become a great lady, straight-backed and bright-eyed. But the face was the same, and the dark eyes were the same, and they were warm. You came, Isolde said. I confess I was not certain you would. Rawthorne tells me you nearly refused. Your Grace. Lydia sank into the deepest curtsy she knew, which was not very deep, for no one had ever taught her how. I beg your pardon. I did not know. In the salon I did not. You did not know I was a duchess, and so you treated me as a person. Isolde took her hands and drew her up. Child, do you not understand? That is the whole miracle of it. You owe me no apology. It is I, and this entire house, who owe you a debt. She turned. Evander. Come and meet the only honest woman in London. And the Duke of Stonehurst came forward, out of the shadow of the great staircase. Lydia had seen handsome men before, in the way that one sees fine carriages pass, knowing they belong to another world. But she had never stood close to one. And the Duke was tall, and dark, and grave, and he looked at her with eyes the color of slate before a storm. He wore black, as the man in the far doorway of the salon had worn black, and with a small shock she realized it had been him. that he had perhaps been at the salon that very day, and she had never marked him. He did not smile. He inclined his head, the smallest courtesy, and when he spoke his voice was low and measured. "Miss Thornton, my mother is not a woman easily moved." "You appear to have moved her a great deal." His gaze held hers. "You have my thanks for the kindness you showed her." "It was nothing, Your Grace," Lydia said. "Truly, anyone would have no," the Duke said. "They would not. A roomful of people did not. That is rather the point of the exercise. There was something dry in it, almost weary. My mother has a fondness for tests. I am only glad that this once someone passed." Lydia did not know what to say to that, so she said the only true thing she had. "I came to thank Her Grace and to ask after the wages Madame Belmont kept from me. 3 weeks' work, sir, 18 shillings. I earned them honestly, and they are mine, and that is all I have come for. I want nothing else." She saw the Duke's brows rise, just slightly. She saw him look at her then in a different way, as though she had said something that did not fit the shape of the people who usually stood in his hall. 18 shillings, he repeated. 18, Your Grace. I would not take a penny more than I am owed." A silence. Then, to her astonishment, the corner of the Duke's grave mouth moved, not quite into a smile, but toward one. "Most people who stand where you are standing, Miss Thornton," he said, "ask for rather more than 18 shillings. "Then most people," said Lydia, before she could stop herself, "have never had to earn 18 shillings. The words were out before she could call them back. She felt the heat rush to her face. One did not speak so to a duke. She had ruined it, whatever it was. But the Dowager Duchess laughed aloud, a clear, delighted sound, and even the Duke's eyes had warmed, just perceptibly, like a window with a candle lit far back in the room. "You will stay," Isolde declared. "Not as a servant, child, never that. As my companion. An old woman wants company she can trust, and I find I trust no one in this city but you. You will have a proper room, proper meals, and proper wages, and you will keep an old woman from dying of the dullness of her own relations. Your Grace, I could not." "You could, and you shall. Unless," as Isolde's eyes twinkled, "you find the 18 shillings a better offer." It was at that moment that the hall doors opened a second time, and a tall, proud woman in dark silk swept in, drawing off her gloves, and the warmth in the room thinned at once like breath on glass. This was Lady Lavinia Harrowby, the Duke's aunt, his late father's sister, who had kept the social affairs of the family in her iron grip for 30 years. She was handsome in the way old marble is handsome, cold and exact, and she had a way of looking at a person that made them recount, instantly, every imperfection of their dress. She looked at Lydia. She took in the thin cloak, the worn boots, as the work-run hands, and her face closed like a fan. "And who," she said, "is this?" "This," said the Dowager Duchess pleasantly, "is Miss Lydia Thornton, who is to be my companion. Lydia, my sister-in-law, Lady Lavinia." "Your companion," Lavinia's voice could have frosted the windows. "Isolde, may I speak with you?" "Privately. You may speak before Lydia. She will hear every conversation in this house soon enough, being my companion, and I would rather she hear them honestly than through keyholes." Lavinia's nostrils thinned. "Very well. Then I will say it plainly. A girl off the street, of no family, no fortune, and no name, installed in Stonehurst House in the very season the Duke must marry. Have you considered, Isolde, how this will look? Have you considered the talk?" "I have considered," said Isolde, "that I am old, and I am rich, and I am tired of being lonely, and I will have whatever companion pleases me. The talk may go hang." "It is not your name the talk will harm," Lavinia said, and her eyes flicked once coldly to the Duke. "Evander, surely you see I see," the Duke said quietly, "a woman who kept my mother from freezing and was thrown into the snow for it. I see that this house owes her a debt. and I see that if my mother wishes a companion, my mother shall have one." His voice did not rise, but something in it ended the discussion as surely as a closed door. "Miss Thornton stays. Roththorn will arrange her wages. We will not speak of it again." Lavinia's mouth pressed into a thin white line. She turned without another word and swept up the great staircase, and her silk hissed against the marble like something cold, finding its way out. Lydia stood in the great hall between a duchess who had defended her and a duke who had just commanded the world to make room for her, and she did not understand any of it. She understood only one thing, watching the duke's grave dark arc eyes, before he turned and went back to his study. She understood that her quiet, small, invisible life was over, and that she had stepped, in her worn boots, onto a stage far larger and far more dangerous than any she had ever known. That night, in a room with a fire and clean linen and a window looking out over snow-covered gardens, Lydia Thornton lay awake a long time, and could not have said whether her heart pounded from fear or from something else she had no name for yet. The news travelled through Mayfair the way such news always does, quietly at first, then everywhere at once. A girl at Stonehurst House, a nobody, some said a maid, some said a beggar, some said worse. The Dowager Duchess had taken her up as a companion, and the Duke himself had defended her in his own hall, and what could it mean but trouble? Lady Seraphina Morkant heard of it within a day, and the day after that she heard the rest, that the old woman she had mocked in Madame Belmont's salon had been no beggar at all, but the Dowager, Duchess in disguise, and that the maid she had called a creature was now living beneath the Duke's roof. She sat very still at her dressing-table when she understood it, and the only sign of her fury was the way the silver brush trembled in her hand. "She tested us," Seraphina said. "The old woman tested us, and we none of us knew, and that wretched servant." She set the brush down with great care. "Alaric." Her brother lounged in the doorway. "I heard. The whole city has heard. Do you understand what it means? If the Dowager Duchess favors her, if the Duke favors her," she could not finish it. A maid in Stonehurst House. "As a companion," Alaric said, "not as a bride. A man does not marry his mother's companion. You do not know him as I mean to know him." Seraphina rose. "And you do not know how a man's heart can turn when a clever woman whispers in his ear from across the breakfast table every morning. No, she must go. Before she becomes anything more than a curiosity, she must go." So Lady Seraphina paid a call at Stonehurst House. She came under the excuse of consulting the Dowager Duchess about the seating for the winter ball. And she was all sweetness, all warmth, kissing Isolde's cheek, and exclaiming over the cold weather. And when she was introduced to Lydia, she smiled her loveliest smile and said, "How charming, how very charming, that dear Isolde should have found such a faithful little friend." It was only later, when the two of them chanced to be alone for a moment in the long gallery, that the smile fell from Seraphina's face like a dropped mask. "I know what you are," she said quietly. "I know exactly what you are. A scrousing girl who got lucky with an old woman's whim. You may have charmed the Dowager, but charm fades, and whims pass. And when this one passes, you will be back in the gutter where you belong. Only a little further down for having seen what you cannot have." She stepped closer. "Do not look at the Duke. Do not speak to the Duke. Do not so much as dream of the Duke. He is mine. He has always been mine. And girls like you do not take what belongs to ladies like me." Lydia looked at her steadily. Her heart was beating hard, but she had spent 3 years learning to keep her face still while cruelty was poured over her, and she did not flinch now. "I have not looked at the Duke, my lady," she said quietly. "I have no thought of him at all. I am here to be company to his mother, and when she has no further need of me, I will go and trouble no one. You need not fear me. There is nothing in me to fear." It was the truth, or she believed it was. But Serafina heard only insolence, and insolence from a maid was a wound she would not forget. "We shall see," Serafina said, and recovered her smile just as the Dowager Duchess returned, and was all sweetness again. That evening, in the Morkent townhouse, brother and sister spoke long into the night. "It is worse than I thought," Serafina said. "The Duke watches her. I saw it. When she crossed the room, he watched her, the way he has never once watched me." Alaric's restless eyes narrowed. He was a young man with a great many debts and a family name that grew thinner every year, and the marriage of his sister to the Duke of Stonehurst was not, for him, a matter of the heart. It was a matter of survival. Stonehurst money would clear the Morkent debts. Stonehurst influence would open doors that had begun quietly to close. "Then a rumor or two," Alaric said slowly, to remind the city what she is, that she was turned out of the salon for dishonesty, that she schemes after the Duke. Nothing crude, only enough that no respectable house receives her, and the shine wears off the novelty. He smiled his cold smile. "And we shall need Madame Belmont. She has reason of her own to want the girl ruined." For Madame Belmont, it transpired, was already frightened. In the days since the dismissal, the Duke's solicitor had been making quiet inquiries into the salon, and two of her wealthiest customers had withdrawn their custom without explanation. And a third had asked, pointedly, whether it was true that the finest work in the house had been done by a maid and sold under Madame Belmont's name. The ground was shifting beneath her, and she did not yet know how far it would fall. When Alaric's note came, suggesting they had interests in common regarding a certain Lydia Thornton, Madame Belmont read it twice, and then she sat down at her desk and wrote a careful reply. And so the three of them, the jealous beauty, the desperate brother, and the frightened salon owner, drew together in the dark and began to spin the web that would catch an innocent girl. What none of them knew was that a fourth person had heard the beginning of it. Miss Viola Pemberley had been sent to the Morkent house that evening to deliver a fitted bodice, and she had been kept waiting in a cold side passage, and through a door left ajar she had heard fragments, a maid, the Duke, a rumor, ruin, the word framed, spoken once, and quickly hushed. She did not understand all of it, but she understood enough to be afraid, and she understood that it was Lydia they meant, the only person in the salon who had ever been kind to her. She walked home through the snow, with the swallowed stone of her old silence growing, heavier in her chest, and she did not yet know what she would do about it. She knew only that she could not this time do nothing forever. The weeks that followed were the strangest and the sweetest of Lydia's life. She woke each morning in her warm room and could scarcely believe it was hers. She took breakfast with the Dowager Duchess, who proved to have a tongue as sharp as any blade, and used it chiefly on the absent failings of her relations, which made Lydia laugh until she had to press her napkin to her mouth. She read to Isolde in the afternoons, and walked with her in the cold gardens, and listened to the old woman's stories of a Stonehurst that had been of the late Duke, Evander's father, whom Isolde had loved with a fierceness that still shone in her voice all these years on. And in the quiet hours, Lydia did what she could not help but do. She found work for her hands. She noticed that the great house, for all its grandeur, was full of small, neglected things. A tapestry with a fraying edge. A set of bed hangings gone thin at the folds, and one gown in particular, an old gown of dove-gray silk, which she found one afternoon laid across a chair in the Dowager Duchess's dressing room, its hem torn and one sleeve coming away at the seam. "That old thing," Isolde said when she found Lydia studying it. "I cannot wear it. The seams are gone, and I cannot give it away. It was the gown I wore the night Evander's father proposed to me, in the long gallery with all the candles lit, 35 years ago this winter. I have kept it like a fool, but I cannot bear to see it ruined, so I keep it out of sight. She sighed, vanity child, the vanity of an old woman who was once a girl in love. Lydia held the grey silk to the light. It is not ruined, Your Grace, she said softly. The seams have only let go. The silk itself is sound. If you would permit me, I could mend it. I could make it whole again. No one would ever know it had been torn. Isolde looked at her. You can do that? I can do that. And so for 3 evenings Lydia sat by the fire with the grey silk in her lap and her mother's needles in her hand, and she gave the old gown back its life. She drew the seams together so finely that the stitches vanished. She set the sleeve whole again. She turned the torn hem and pressed it smooth, and when she was finished the gown looked as it must have looked 35 years before on a winter night in a gallery full of candles. It was on the 3rd evening late that the Duke found her there. He had not meant to. He had come down for a book he had left in the small drawing-room, and he stopped in the doorway when he saw her by the fire, her head bent over the silver-grey silk, her face soft and absorbed in the firelight, her needle flashing. She did not hear him. He stood and watched her work, and something in his chest, long held shut, eased open the smallest crack. That is my mother's gown, he said at last, quietly, so as not to startle her. Lydia looked up. She rose at once, the silk gathered in her arms. Your Grace, forgive me. I did not hear you. Her Grace asked me to mend it. The seams had gone. May I see? She brought it to him, and he took the grey silk and turned it in the firelight, and he found the old hem and the old seams, and could find no trace of any wound. He looked for a long moment, and Lydia saw something move in his grave face that she had not seen there before. She wore this the night my father proposed to her, the Duke said. She told you that, I expect. She did. She has wept over this gown. I have seen her. She thought it past saving. He looked up from the silk, and his slate-grey eyes found Lydia's, and held them. You did not merely mend a gown, Miss Thornton. You have given my mother back a night she thought she had lost. Do you understand that? I only mended the seams, Your Grace, Lydia said, very low. No, said the Duke. You did rather more than that. You seem to make a habit of it. The fire snapped. Outside the tall windows the snow fell silent and silver. They stood close, the grey gown between them, and for a moment neither of them moved, and the great house was very quiet around them. They tell me, the Duke said at last, that you were the finest pair of hands in that salon, and that Belmont sold your work as her own. Is it true? Lydia hesitated. I did the work, Your Grace. What name was put to it was not mine to decide, and you never spoke. You never claimed it. 3 years, and you never once said, this is mine. A poor woman cannot always afford pride, sir, Lydia said. Pride is a fine thing for those who can pay for it. For the rest of us, silence keeps the roof over our heads. I had a roof. I held my tongue. It is not noble. It is only how one survives. The Duke was quiet a long moment. Then he said, in a different voice, lower, and yet you did not hold your tongue when my mother was being thrown into the snow. You spoke then. When speaking cost you everything. That was different, Lydia said simply. That was a person freezing. A roof is only a roof. He looked at her then, as though he were seeing her properly for the first time. This small, steady woman in a plain dress, who had lost her livelihood for a stranger, and given an old woman back her youth with a needle and thread, and who reckoned 18 shillings, the limit of what the world owed her. He had spent 7 years among people who wanted everything and gave nothing. And here was one who wanted nothing and gave all she had and did not even think it remarkable. Good night, Miss Thornton, the Duke said at last, and his voice was not cold at all. Good night, Your Grace. He took his book and he went. But at the door he paused and looked back once, and Lydia, bending again over the grey silk, felt his gaze upon her like the warmth of the fire, and did not dare look up until she heard his footsteps fade away down the marble hall. The Dowager Duchess, who had seen a great deal in 63 years, and was at that moment watching from the dark of the gallery above, with a small, private smile, said nothing at all. But the next morning at breakfast she remarked, apropos of nothing, that her son had not looked so awake in a very long while, and then she asked Lydia, with great innocence, to pass the marmalade, and change the subject before the girl's blush had even fully bloomed. Lavinia, who was also at breakfast, saw the blush, and saw a great deal more besides, and her old face hardened. "A word of warning, Miss Thornton," she said coldly, when Isolde had left the room. "You are a clever girl, I do not doubt it. But there is a kind of cleverness that ends a woman. Do not let an old duchess's affection and a young duke's gratitude turn your head. He must marry his equal. He will marry his equal. And the higher you let yourself be carried now, the harder the ground will be when you fall. I tell you this not to wound you, but to spare you. Know your place, child, while there is still a place to know." Lydia met her eyes. "I know exactly what I am, my lady," she said quietly. "I have never once forgotten it. It is everyone else in this house who keeps trying to make me forget." And she rose and curtsied and left Lady Lavinia alone at the long table with her cold tea and her colder certainties and the uncomfortable beginning of a suspicion that the maid might be cleverer and finer than she had allowed. The rumours came, as Alaric had promised, quietly at first, then everywhere. It was said in drawing-rooms across Mayfair that the Duke of Stonehurst had taken a scheming maid into his house. It was said she had been turned out of Belmont's salon for dishonesty, for thieving, even, that she had wormed her way into an old woman's affections by trickery, and that she had her eye fixed firmly on the Duke's title and the Duke's fortune. Madame Belmont, applied to by curious ladies, would sigh and look pained and say that she did not like to speak ill, but that yes, regrettably, the girl had been dismissed for conduct she would rather not describe, and that she had warned the salon's clientele, but, alas, who listens to a poor tradeswoman? It was clever work. There was nothing a person could seize and disprove, only a fog of whispers that thickened with each telling. Lydia felt it before she understood it. She felt it in the way conversations stopped when she entered a room, in the cold civility of the upper servants, in a letter the Dowager Duchess received from an old friend that Isolde read, and then put quietly into the fire without remark. She was not a fool. She knew what was being said. She went to the Dowager Duchess one grey morning, and she said what she had been turning over in her heart for days. "Your Grace, I think I must go." Isolde set down her cup. "Go." "Go where? Away." "Somewhere I will not be the cause of trouble for this family. They are saying things, ma'am. About me. About what I am and why I am here. And every word of it touches your name and the Duke's, and I will not be the reason your house is laughed at. I have brought you nothing but talk. Let me go quietly, and the talk will go with me." Isolde was silent for a moment. Then she reached out and took Lydia's hand, and her grip was surprisingly strong. "Listen to me, child," she said. "I have lived in this world a long time, and I will tell you the truth of it. The talk you fear is not about you at all. It is about them. It is the sound frightened people make when someone good frightens them by being good. They cannot bear that you helped me when they would not. They cannot bear that you ask for 18 shillings when they would have asked for the moon. So they must make you small and dirty in their stories, because if you are dirty, then their own cleanness is safe." Her dark eyes glittered. "I will not let a lie chase you out of my house. If you go, you go because you wish to go, not because cowards have whispered. Do you wish to go?" Lydia's eyes had filled. No, Your Grace, she said, I do not wish to go. Then you shall not, and we shall do better than hide you from the talk. We shall walk you straight into the middle of it, with your head up on my arm, where all the world can see. So it was. That, to the astonishment of Mayfair, when the Stonehurst Winter Ball was held, that January, the Dowager Duchess Isolde Harrowby entered upon the arm of Miss Lydia Thornton, introduced not as a servant, but as her dear companion, and the woman to whom she owed a debt of kindness, and dared the whole glittering room to say a word against her. The ballroom of Stonehurst House blazed with 1,000 candles. Lydia wore a gown of deep blue silk that the Dowager Duchess had given her, and her brown hair was dressed simply, and she was, several gentlemen remarked in low voices, by far the most striking woman in the room, precisely because she alone seemed to have no idea that she was. She did not flutter. She did not simper. She stood straight and quiet beside the old Duchess, and met every cold eye with a steady one of her own. Lady Seraphina was magnificent in the green silk gown, with the longest train in the room, the one she had ordered, so that she would be remembered. But she was not the woman the room remembered that night. And she knew it, and the knowledge curdled in her like milk left in the sun. The Duke danced first, with his mother, as was proper, and then, before the whole assembled glitter of London society, before his aunt's stiffening face and Seraphina's frozen smile, the Duke of Stonehurst crossed the floor and bowed to Lydia Thornton and asked her to dance. A sound went through the room, not quite a gasp, the held breath of 300 people who had just watched the unthinkable. Your Grace, Lydia murmured, you cannot. They will say. They will say a great many things, the Duke said, his hand already extended. They always do. I have grown tired of arranging my life around the things small people say. Will you dance with me, Lydia, or will you let them win? She put her hand in his, and they danced, and the whole room watched, and Lydia, who had been taught no steps, and had only watched the seamstress's daughters practice in the back rooms, found that, with the Duke's hand at her waist, and his eyes on hers, the steps came easily, as though her body had always known them. She felt the warmth of his hand through the silk. She felt his eyes move over her face. She felt, for the length of one waltz, that the whole world had narrowed to the two of them and the candles and the music, and that nothing else existed at all. You dance, he said, low, as though you have done it all your life. I have done it only in my dreams, Your Grace, she said, before she could think better of it, and only ever with one partner whom I never expected to meet. His hand tightened, just slightly, at her waist. His breath was not quite steady. And does the partner of your dreams disappoint you, now that he is real? No, Lydia whispered, no, he does not disappoint me at all. Across the room, the Dowager Duchess watched her son, and the maid turned together in the candlelight, and she pressed her handkerchief to her lips, and there were tears in her old eyes, but they were glad ones. Across the room, Lady Lavinia watched, and her certainties trembled, and across the room, Lady Seraphina Morkant watched, and her beautiful face was a mask of porcelain over something that had cracked clean through, and she turned to her brother and said, very quietly through her smile, now. It must be now. The rumor is not enough. We end her now, or we lose everything. Alaric's cold eyes followed the dancers. It is in hand, he murmured. Belmont sends the hat box tomorrow. By the engagement supper, the maid will be a thief, and a thief does not dance with dukes. He smiled. Let her have tonight, sister. It is the last good night she will know. There was at Stonehurst House a single jewel that mattered more than all the rest. It was the Harrowby sapphire brooch, a great dark blue stone set round with diamonds, that had belonged to the Duke's grandmother and her grandmother before her, worn by every Harrowby bride and matriarch for 100 years. It lived in a velvet case in the Dowager Duchess's rooms, and it was, beyond its value in gold, the very heart of the family, the thing that said, "This is who we are, and we endure." The Dowager Duchess meant to wear it at the engagement supper, for there was to be an engagement supper. Lady Lavinia, alarmed beyond measure by what she had seen at the ball, had taken matters into her own proud hands and arranged it. A grand formal supper at which, she was determined, the Duke would do his duty and announce his engagement to Lady Seraphina Morcant, and put an end to the madness of the maid once and for all. She had not consulted the Duke. She had simply sent the invitations, trusting that the weight of society, once assembled, would force his hand. It was a desperate stroke, but Lavinia was desperate, and she believed, still, that she was saving him. Seraphina, for her part, intended to wear something even finer than her ball gown, and so a hat box was sent from Madame Belmont's salon to Stonehurst House 2 days before. The supper, containing trimmings and a new headpiece for Her Grace's approval, or so the note said. It was Alaric's design, and it was simple, and it was cruel. The hat box had a false bottom. Beneath the trimmings hidden in the lining was the means of Lydia's ruin, for inside that false bottom, Seraphina, who had come to the house the day before on yet another sweet pretext, and slipped away alone for the space of 10 minutes, had concealed the Harrowby sapphire brooch, taken from its case while the Dowager Duchess napped, and then she had carried a small portion of the hat box contents to Lydia's room, as a supposed gift from Madame Belmont, a peace offering, and among them, deep in a fold of tissue, she had tucked the great dark stone. The trap was laid. All that remained was to spring it. It was sprung the morning of the supper. The theft of the brooch was discovered, the Dowager Duchess's maid crying out that the case was empty, the whole house thrown into uproar. And in the search that followed, ordered by a white and furious Lady Lavinia, it was Lydia's room that was searched, and it was in Lydia's room, in a fold of tissue among Madame Belmont's gift, that the great sapphire brooch was found, dark and damning, in the hands of the very housekeeper who drew it out. "There," said Lady Lavinia, and her voice shook with vindication and with something almost like grief. "There it is. I am sorry, Isolde. I am more sorry than I can say, but I told you. I told you what she was." The household gathered in the great hall. The servants whispered, and Lydia stood in the center of it all, white as the snow outside, looking at the brooch in the housekeeper's hand as though it were a snake. "I have never seen it," she said. Her voice was very quiet. "I have never touched it. I did not put it there. Before God, I did not." "It was in your room," said Lavinia, "in your possession, among your things. Do you deny it was found there?" "I cannot deny what your own eyes saw," Lydia said. "I can only tell you it was not put there by my hand. Someone has placed it among the things sent to me. I do not know who. I swear to you I do not know." "Convenient," murmured a voice, and it was Seraphina, who had arrived early and stood now at the edge of the hall, the very picture of grieved propriety. "The poor wretch took fright, I expect, and meant to sell it and flee. They always do, these girls. One feels for them, truly. It is the want that drives them. But want is not innocence." "Be silent," said the Duke. He had come down at the first alarm, and he stood now at the foot of the great staircase, and his face was terrible, but not in the way Seraphina had hoped. He was not looking at Lydia with disgust. He was looking at the brooch, and at the room, and at the faces in it, with the cold, narrow attention of a man who has begun, very rapidly, to think. "Lydia," he said. "Look at me." She lifted her eyes to his. "Did you take it?" "No, Your Grace." Her voice did not waver. "On my mother's grave and my own soul, I did not." He held her gaze for a long moment. Then he turned to the room. "Then we have a difficulty," he said, "because the brooch did not walk into Miss Thornton's room on its own. and I do not for one instant believe she put it there. Which means someone in this house, or someone with reach into this house, is a liar and a thief far more dangerous than any pilfering maid. His slate eyes swept the hall and came to rest, for the briefest moment, on Serafina's lovely, composed face. And I intend to find out who. Evander? Lavinia's voice cracked. The evidence, the Duke said, is a stone in a box. Anyone may put a stone in a box. I deal in evidence, Aunt, not in the appearance of it. He turned to his solicitor, who had appeared silent at his elbow. Rowthorn, sir. The hatbox it was sent in. Find it. Examine every inch of it. And I want to know the movements of every person who has entered this house in the last 3 days. Servant and guest alike. Quietly. At once, sir. But Lydia, standing alone in the center of the cold hall with every eye upon her, and the great sapphire glittering in the housekeeper's hand, had already made up her mind. She saw the Dowager Duchess's stricken face. She saw Lavinia's grief. She saw the whispering servants, some of whom, she knew, already believed the worst of her. And she understood that whatever the Duke believed, whatever the truth might be, her presence in that house was now a wound that would not close while she remained. Your Grace, she said, please, let me go. The Duke turned to her sharply. You will not go. To go now is to confess to a thing you did not do. To stay now, Lydia said, and her voice was steady, though her heart was breaking, is to bring this house into the mud, day after day, while you hunt for a proof that may never come. They have made me a thief, sir, and a thief under your roof shames your mother's name with every hour I remain. I will not do that to her. I will not do that to you. She looked at the Dowager Duchess, and her composure nearly failed. You took me in when no one else would, and I will repay you by sparing you the scandal of defending me. Let me go quietly. It is the only gift I have left to give this house. Lydia, the Duke crossed the hall to her, heedless of the watching faces, and took her by the arms, and his voice dropped low and rough. Listen to me. If you walk out that door, they win. Do you understand? Every cruel small person who has whispered against you wins. I do not believe you took it. I will prove you did not take it. Stay and let me prove it. For a moment, looking up into his grave, dark face, so close to hers, she nearly stayed. She felt the warmth of his hands through her sleeves and the urgency in his voice. And she wanted, more than she had ever wanted anything, to do as he asked. But she shook her head. You cannot prove a thing in time to save your mother's name from a fortnight of poison, she said softly, and I will not buy my own comfort with her good name. Goodbye, Your Grace. Thank you for the dance. I shall keep it. Her voice broke at last. I shall keep it always. And she gathered her thin cloak and her tin of needles, and she walked out of Stonehurst House into the Snover. For the second time in her life, leaving the great sapphire glittering behind her, and the Duke standing in the cold hall with his hands still half raised, as though he might yet call her back. He did not call her back. But the moment the door had closed, he turned to his solicitor, and his voice was low and hard as iron. Find it all, Rowthorn, he said, every thread. I do not care what it costs or whom it ruins. The woman who just walked out of my house is the only honest soul I have met in 7 years, and I will see her cleared before this city if it is the last thing I do as Duke of Stonehurst. His jaw tightened, and then I will see the people who did this to her answer for every minute of it. Yes, sir, said Edmund Rowthorn, and for the first time in many years, the grave solicitor smiled a smile that had no kindness in it at all, but only the cold, clean promise of justice. Lydia went back to the boarding house off Cheapside, and Mrs. Harker, who had heard the rumors, looked at her with new suspicion and demanded the rent a day early. Lydia paid it from the wages the Duke had seen returned to her and took her cold room beneath the eaves again and sat by her gray window, mending gloves for a penny, and tried not to think of candlelight, or of a warm hand at her waist, or of slate-gray eyes that had asked her to stay. She had done the right thing. She told herself so 100 times a day. She had spared the Duke and his mother the scandal of defending a supposed thief. It did not feel like the right thing. It felt like a wound that would not close. But while Lydia mended gloves in the cold, Edmund Rowthorne went hunting, and the Duke went with him, and they were very thorough indeed. They began with the hatbox. Rowthorne took it apart with his own hands, and within the hour he had found the false bottom, the hidden compartment lined with tissue, too clever by half for any honest packing. A hatbox is not built with a secret floor by accident. It is built so by design, and design means a designer. They went next to Madame Belmont's salon, and here the Duke's name did its work, for a frightened tradeswoman facing the withdrawal of a Duke's favor. And the whisper of his solicitor's inquiries is a tradeswoman whose loyalty to her fellow plotters does not run deep. Rowthorne did not even need to threaten. He merely sat in Madame Belmont's parlor with his ledgers and his quiet questions, and let her understand, by slow degrees, exactly how much trouble she was in, and how little Lord Alaric Morkant would do to share it. And in the salon, while the Duke spoke with Madame Belmont, Edmund Rowthorne found Miss Viola Pemberley. She was in the back room, pale and thin, and when she understood who he was and why he had come, the swallowed stone in her chest finally became too heavy to bear. "I cannot," she whispered. "I cannot, sir. She will turn me out. My mother is ill. I have nowhere. I cannot, Miss Pemberley," said Rowthorne gently. "I will tell you a thing about silence. It does not protect us. It only postpones the moment when we must look at ourselves and reckon what our silence bought." He paused. "You knew Miss Thornton. She was kind to you, I think. She shared her dinner with you when you had none." Viola began to cry. "She is in a cold room tonight, Miss Pemberley, accused of a theft she did not commit, her name dragged through every drawing room in London. And you know something. I can see that you know something. The question is only whether you will carry it to your grave, or whether you will, just once, be as brave as she was." He set a card on the table. "I am not here to frighten you. The Duke does not turn out girls who tell the truth. He turns out the ones who tell lies. Come to Stonehurst House before the supper and tell what you heard. And I give you my word as the Duke's man that you will never want for honest. Work again." Viola looked at the card a long time. Then she wiped her eyes and she nodded. What she told them, 2 days later in the Duke's study, broke the case open like an egg. She had been at the Morkant House, kept waiting in a cold passage, and through a door left ajar, she had heard Lord Alaric and his sister speaking of a maid, and the Duke, and a rumor that had not been enough, and a hatbox that would be sent, and a thing that would be found, and the word framed, spoken once, and quickly hushed. She had heard Madame Belmont's name. She had heard Lady Seraphina laugh and say it would be the last good night the creature ever knew. It was not, by itself, proof, but it was a thread, and Rowthorne pulled it, and the rest came. A torn strip of fine green glove, the very green of Seraphina's ball gown, was found by a housemaid caught in the latch of the door to Lydia's old room, where it had snagged when Seraphina slipped in to plant the brooch and torn away in her hurry. Madame Belmont's own ledger surrendered at last, when she understood she would otherwise hang alone, showed 3 secret payments received from Lord Alaric Morkant in the weeks before the theft, and a 4th promised upon the maid's ruin. And the hat box, with its clever false bottom, was traced by its maker, a boxmaker in Spitalfields, who remembered very well the gentleman with the restless eyes who had commissioned a box with a secret floor and paid extra for haste. Thread by thread, the whole ugly garment came apart in the Duke's hands. "We have them," Rowthorne said. laying the last of it on the study desk, the glove, the ledger, the box maker. Miss Pemberley's testimony. It is enough, sir. More than enough. It is enough to clear her quietly, the Duke said. He stood at the window, looking out at the snow, and his face was hard. But I do not want it done quietly. They tried to ruin her before the whole of society. They shall be undone before the whole of society. Aunt Lavinia has arranged a supper at which she expects me to announce my engagement to Lady Seraphina. A grim smile touched his mouth. Then let us have the supper. Let them all come. Let Seraphina wear her finest and her brightest smile, and let the truth come into the room when no one is expecting it. And Miss Thornton, sir? The Duke was silent a moment. Send my mother to fetch her, he said at last, more quietly. Not a servant, not you, Rowthorne, with respect my mother. Tell Lydia that the Dowager Duchess of Stonehurst requests her presence, and that she is to come not as the accused, but as a witness to justice, and tell her he stopped. Tell her that I have not for one single hour stopped believing her. Tell her that exactly. So it was that, on the evening of the great supper, a black carriage drew up once more outside the boarding house off Cheapside, and this time it was the Dowager Duchess herself who climbed the narrow stairs, with Mrs. Harker fluttering and curtsying behind her, and knocked at the door of the cold little room beneath the eaves. Lydia opened it and stared. "Your Grace, get your cloak, child," said Isolde. "Such as it is, we shall buy you a better one tomorrow. Tonight you have an appointment with the truth, and I'll not have you late for it. I cannot come back the brooch." "They think they thought," said the Dowager Duchess, and her old eyes were fierce and bright. "They thought a great many things. And tonight they will be unthought, every last one of them, before a room full of the people who whispered. My son has found it all out, Lydia. The glove, the box, the payments. The girl from the salon who heard them plotting, all of it. You did not take the brooch, and tonight the whole of London will know who did." She took Lydia's cold hands in hers. "He sends you a message. He bids me tell you that he has not, for one single hour, stopped believing you. Now, will you come and watch the wicked fall? Or will you sit here mending gloves while justice is done without you?" Lydia's eyes filled and overflowed. "I am afraid, Your Grace," she whispered. "They are great people, and I am no one. What if the room believes the lady over the maid, even now?" Isolde reached up and touched her cheek, the way a mother might. "Truth, my dear," she said softly, "has a way of entering rooms uninvited, and of staying long after the liars have fled. Trust it. Trust my son, and trust, just this once, that you are not no one. You never were." She smiled. "Now get your cloak. The carriage is cold, and I am old, and the wicked are waiting to be surprised." And Lydia Thornton got her cloak and her mother's needles, and went down the narrow stairs and out into the snow and into the carriage toward Stonehurst House, and the supper, and the truth. The great dining hall of Stonehurst House had never blazed so bright. 100 candles burned in the crystal above the long table, and the table itself ran the length of the room, laid with gold and silver and glass that threw the light back in 1,000 pieces. The flower of London society sat along its length, dukes and countesses, and ladies and lords, and the air hummed with the low music of their talk, and every one of them believed they knew why they had been summoned. Lady Lavinia had made certain of it. Tonight, the Duke of Stonehurst would announce his engagement to Lady Seraphina Morkent, and the unpleasant business of the thieving maid would be sealed forever beneath the proper order of things. Lady Seraphina sat near the head of the table in a gown of silver and rose, more beautiful than she had ever been, and her smile was the smile of a woman who was already won. Beside her sat her brother, Lord Alaric, his restless eyes calm at last, for the game was nearly over and they had played it well. Lower down sat Madame Belmont, invited by Lavinia as a respectable tradeswoman who had given testimony as to the maid's character. And she too was content, for she had been promised her reward, and a duke's renewed custom would more than mend the small troubles of the past weeks. The Dowager Duchess sat at the foot of the table, very upright, very quiet, in dove-grey silk that some of the older guests thought they half remembered, and the Duke rose. The talk fell away. Glasses were set down. 300 eyes turned to the head of the table, where the Duke of Stonehurst stood tall and grave in his black evening dress, and a held breath went round the room. "My friends," he said, "I thank you for coming. My aunt has told you, I believe, that there is to be an announcement tonight." A murmur of pleased assent. Serafina's smile deepened. "She is quite right. There is, but it is not the one she led you to expect." The murmur changed its note. "Before any man speaks of marriage," the Duke went on, "he must first see his house set in order, and my house has been gravely disordered. Some weeks ago, a sapphire brooch, the heart of my family for 100 years, was found in the room of a young woman who had shown my mother the only kindness she received in a city, full of cruelty. That young woman was named a thief. She was driven from this house. Her name was carried through your drawing rooms, like refuse." His eyes moved slowly down the table. "I told you there would be an announcement. Here it is. Lydia Thornton did not steal the Harrowby brooch, and I can prove before all of you exactly who did." The room went utterly still. "Evander," said Lady Lavinia, half rising, "the brooch was found in her own room. It was placed in her room," the Duke said, "by a hand that wore green that night." He nodded, and the doors at the side of the hall opened, and Edmund Rowthorne came in, and behind him, pale and trembling but upright, came Miss Viola Pemberley. "I will let the evidence speak, Rowthorne." And Rowthorne spoke in his quiet, exact voice, and laid each thread upon the table for all to see. He told of the hatbox with the secret floor, and produced the boxmaker's account of the gentleman, with restless eyes, who had paid extra for haste. Lord Alaric's smile died. He told of the green glove, torn at the door of the maid's room, and laid the silk strip on the white cloth, and every eye turned to Lady Serafina, whose ball gown all the room remembered, and her face began, very slowly, to crack. He produced Madame Belmont's own ledger, and read aloud the 3 secret payments from Lord Alaric Morcant, and the 4th promised upon the maid's ruin, and Madame Belmont, seeing herself betrayed by her own careful bookkeeping, gave a small choked cry, and looked wildly toward the doors. And then Viola Pemberley, trembling like a leaf, told in a small clear voice what she had heard through a door, left ajar in the Morcant house. The maid, the Duke, the rumour that had not been enough, the hatbox. The thing that would be found, the word framed, and Lady Serafina's laugh, and her promise that it would be the last good night the creature ever knew. The silence in the great hall was the silence of 300 people who had come to witness a triumph, and found themselves witnessing a fall. "It is a lie," Serafina said, but her voice had no power in it. "It is a conspiracy of servants and tradespeople against their betters. Evander, surely you will not take the word of a servant over a lady." The Duke's voice was very quiet and very cold. "I will take the word of an honest woman over a liar, Lady Serafina, every day that I live, whatever gown the liar wears. The glove is yours. The hatbox is your brother's. The payments are in Madame Belmont's own hand. And 4 witnesses heard the plot in your own house. You did not lose a brooch. You lost yourself. The day you decided that an old woman freezing in the snow was a thing to laugh at." He turned, then, to the foot of the table where the Dowager Duchess sat in her dove-grey silk. "Mother," he said, "will you tell them the rest?" And Isosald rose. "I will tell you a small story," the Dowager Duchess said, and her clear old voice carried to every corner of the silent hall. "Some weeks ago, I grew weary of being smiled at by people who saw only my son's title and never my face. So I dressed myself as a beggar in a torn cloak and broken boots, and I went out into the cold to see how the fine people of this city behave toward those who can do nothing for them. I was turned from three doorways, and at the last, in the grandest salon in London, I was mocked and called a beggar to my face, and very nearly thrown back into the snow by hired hands. Her dark eyes found Serafina, and one lady, a great beauty, looked at me and told me that some stains never come out. She meant me. I have not forgotten it. Serafina had gone white as paper, but there was one person in that whole glittering room, Isolde went on, and now her voice softened, and her eyes moved down the hall to the doors, who saw not a beggar, but a cold old woman, who knelt on the fine floor and took the frozen gloves from my hands and wrapped them warm, who gave me tea and called me ma'am as though I were a queen, and who, when I asked her why she would risk her place for a stranger in rags, told me that cold is cold, whether it touches a duchess or a beggar. The Dowager Duchess's voice trembled now. She was dismissed for it, thrown into the snow, and then framed as a thief by these people at my own table, because she had earned the love of this family by being the only decent soul among 10,000. Bring her in. The doors opened, and Lydia Thornton walked into the great blazing hall in her thin cloak, with her mother's needles in her pocket and her head held high, and 300 of the finest people in London turned to look at the maid they had whispered about, and did not any of them dare to whisper now. The Duke came down the length of the hall to meet her. He stopped before her, and in the candlelight, before all of society, before his aunt and his mother, and the ruined faces of the people who had tried to destroy her, he took her hand. "Lydia Thornton," he said, and his voice carried to every corner, "I owe you an apology on behalf of every person in this room who let a lie about you go unanswered. Your name is cleared tonight and forever. I am sorry it took me so long." "You came for me, Your Grace," Lydia whispered, and her eyes were full. "That is all that matters. You came for me." "I will always come for you," the Duke said, low, so that only she could hear. "I have only just begun to understand how far I would come. What followed, the guests would speak of for years. Lord Alaric Morcant, seeing the law itself approaching in the person of the magistrate, the Duke had quietly invited, made for the doors, and was stopped, and would answer in the months to come for bribery, for fraud, and for conspiracy. And the ancient Morcant name, already thin, would not survive it. Lady Serafina, stripped of her triumph before the whole of the society she had ruled, fled the hall in tears that moved no one, and found in the weeks that followed that the doors of every great house in London had quietly closed against her, and that beauty without character buys nothing once the buyers have seen the truth. Madame Belmont lost her wealthy clients, her reputation, and at last her salon itself, for the Duke withdrew his favor and let the city know why, and a salon that the city will not enter is no salon at all, and Lady Lavinia Harrowby, who had believed, to the very end, that she was protecting her family, sat at the long table amid the wreckage of her certainties, and understood at last that she had nearly helped destroy the finest thing ever to enter her house. She rose, old and proud, and she crossed the hall to Lydia, and before all of society she did a thing that no one who knew her had ever seen her do. She bowed her head. "I was wrong about you," Lady Lavinia said, and her voice shook. "I thought family honor was a thing of blood and name, to be guarded against girls like you. I see now that you have more honor in your mending hands than I have learned in 60 years. I am sorry, child. I am more sorry than my pride knows how to say. Will you forgive an old woman who should have known better?" And Lydia, who had been called a creature and a thief in that very city, took took the old woman's hands in her own. "There is nothing to forgive, my lady," she said gently. "You loved your family and feared for it. That is not a sin. It is only love wearing the wrong face." And Lady Lavinia wept, and was, from that night, Lydia's fiercest friend in all of London. The Duke did not propose that night. He was too fine a man to turn a night of justice into a spectacle for himself. He waited until the guests had gone, and the candles had burned low, and the great house was quiet. And then he found Lydia in the long gallery, standing before the spot where his father had once proposed to his mother in a room full of candles, 35 years before. "Lydia," he said. She turned. "I have spent 7 years," the Duke said, "believing that everyone who came near me wanted something. My title, my fortune, my name, and then a maid asked me for 18 shillings and not one penny more, and gave my mother back her youth with a needle, and walked out of my house rather than let a lie touch the name of the family that had wronged her." He came closer. "I do not want to marry my equal, Lydia. I have met my equals all my life, and found them wanting. I want to marry the one woman I have ever met, who is better than I am. Will you have me? Not as a duke. As a man who has, at last, learned the difference between what glitters and what is gold." Lydia looked up at him, this grave dark man who had come for her when no one else would. And her heart was so full she could scarcely speak. "I am only a maid, Evander," she whispered. "I have nothing. I have a tin of needles and a thin cloak and a great deal of love I never dared give anyone." "Then give it to me," the Duke said. "I find I have spent my whole life waiting for exactly that and never knew it until you knelt on a salon floor for a stranger in rags." He took her face in his hands. "Give it to me, Lydia, and I will spend the rest of my days proving I was worth the giving." And there, in the long gallery, in the very spot where the old Duke had once won his duchess, beneath the eyes of 100 Harrowby portraits and the soft glow of the dying candles, the Duke of Stonehurst kissed the maid who had nothing, and the maid who had nothing kissed him back with everything she had kept, folded small inside her for so long, and the long, cold winter of both their lives broke at last into spring. They were married in the early summer, in the chapel at Stonehurst, and the Dowager Duchess wore the dove-grey gown that Lydia had mended, the gown of 35 years before, and wept the entire time, and declared afterward that she had never in her life cried so much from happiness, and that she did not regret a single tear. And dear viewers, if Lydia's journey from a mocked maid to the Duchess of Stonehurst has touched your heart, do not leave this old house quietly. Take a moment, before our tale is fully told, to subscribe, to leave a like, and to tell us where in the world you are watching from, the country, the hour, the day. Your comments become part of this little gathering of story lovers around the fire, and your kindness helps us bring you more tales of hidden heirs and proud dukes, of brave women and the secrets buried beneath silk and candlelight. Stay with us now, for there is one chapter of Lydia's story still to come, and it is the sweetest of them all. Lydia Thornton became the Duchess of Stonehurst, and she did not forget where she had come from. One of the first acts of the new Duchess was to ask her husband for a single gift, not jewels, not gowns, but the ruined salon on Harrow Street, which Madame Belmont had lost, and which stood empty and dark. The Duke bought it gladly, and gave it into Lydia's hands, and Lydia opened its doors again, but above them she placed a new sign. It did not bear Madame Belmont's name. It bore the crest of Stonehurst, and beneath it a simple promise, that no woman with honest hands would ever again be turned away for being poor. It became a house where talented poor women learned the trade properly, and were paid honestly, and were thanked for their work in their own names, and the first girl Lydia took in was Miss Viola Pemberley, who had found her courage at last, and never lost it again. and who in time became the finest forewoman in London. Even Mrs. Harker, the landlady, came to be proud that the Duchess of Stonehurst had once mended gloves beneath her eaves, and told the story to anyone who would stand still long enough to hear it. And in the second winter of their marriage, on a night when the snow fell soft and silent over London just as it had fallen, on the day she walked into that salon, Lydia gave birth to a son, the new heir of Stonehurst, dark-haired and grave-eyed like his father, with his mother's quick, gentle hands. Years later, when the boy was grown enough to sleep, without crying, Lydia stood at the nursery window with the Harrowby air warm against her shoulder, watching the snow come down over the gardens, and the old Dowager Duchess, leaning on her cane, came to stand beside her and looked upon the mother and the child for a long, quiet moment. The world mocked a woman in rags, Isolde said softly, and dismissed a maid in an apron. It thought it knew the worth of things. It did not know the half of it. She reached out and touched the sleeping child's dark hair. The future of Stonehurst is safe, my dear. Not because it was born of blood, or name, or pride, but because it was born of kindness. And kindness, in the end, is the only thing that ever endures. Lydia said nothing. She only drew her son a little closer, and watched the snow, and remembered a cold afternoon, and a frozen pair of hands, and a cup of tea given to a stranger, and thought how strange and how wonderful it was that the smallest mercy, offered to one no one else would touch, had grown into the whole of her happiness. Thank you for watching, dear viewers. We are so very grateful that you spent this time with us, here in the warmth of an old house in old Victorian England. May your own kindness, however small, however unnoticed, never be wasted, even when the world does not see it at first. For as Lydia learned, and as the Harrowbys learned with her, the smallest candle of mercy, lit on the coldest day, can warm a whole house for generations. Until our next tale from behind a noble door, keep your candles burning, your hearts gentle, and your ears ready for the next secret waiting to be told. Good night, dear friends. Good night.